This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Across the land, the sigh you hear is one of pure relief. It issues from the football guys, and it is my belief that each of them's delighted that they're finally playing now. And even though the games don't count, they're happy anyhow, for in the world of football, as it's played for lots of money, there's nothing worse than practicing when it is hot and sunny. Now that the NFL exhibition games are, in fact, underway, it's time for me to talk to Paul Attner of the Sporting News. He's our pro football guy. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. And there is something worse than practicing hot and sunny, standing there watching them practice in hot and sunny. I guarantee you that.
I don't doubt it for a minute. And we'll get to the business of players, teams, games, things of that nature. But perhaps we should begin with some discussion of the NFL's new boss. The Paul Tagliabue era ended Tuesday when owners voted to replace the retiring commissioner with Roger Goodell. I gather he's a man whose previous service has prepared him for football leadership.
Yeah, it's in the world of politics, this would be called the safe choice. He's a known entity here, and they were kind of thinking of venturing outside their world and bring in someone from corporate, but I think things are going so well and they're making so much money that why risk the unknown when they know Roger understands the league. I think they feel that they can keep him under control, and I think they recognize that he's done a lot of good for them, including basically building or getting a lot of these stadiums built that way back 10, 12 years ago, baseball was building parks and football was not building stadiums, and Roger is one of the people who got the NFL on the right track. So I think it was a good, safe choice, and it's going to be different, much different than Tagliabue personality-wise. So it'll be interesting to me to see how his personality affects the league, changes the league at all, maybe the way they deal with people. I mean, right now I'm not really fond of the way the league deals at times with people, and I hope Roger does it different.
He's better at that, more of a people person?
Yeah, much better, yeah. I mean, Tagliabue is, and I'm sure you've seen it, and everyone who watches Tagliabue, the body language, there's an arrogance there. There's a fundamental feeling that he's a lot smarter than you are, and he knows it, and no humor. I mean, he's basically a humorless guy, and Roger is more of a guy you could sit down and have a beer with and talk about, I think, life, where I don't think Tagliabue had much interest in small talk. So, yeah, it's a different feeling with the commissioner's post, a little bit more towards Pete Rozelle, who is really kind of a man's man, and I think Roger's more that way. Paul Tagliabue is more the scholar, the aloof kind of guy, and this is not how it's going to be now.
It's hard to imagine that the National Football League, which enjoys annual revenues in the billions of dollars, has many serious problems, but what are some of the issues that will face the new commissioner as he begins his job?
Well, the most fundamental one is the one that Tagliabue wrestled with before he left office, and I think is the reason he's out of there now, because he doesn't want to wrestle with anymore, is the quote, new ownership, unquote. The new owners who don't recognize the fact that the league has flourished because of revenue sharing. They see it, but they don't want to buy into it. They're finding ways as much as possible to try not to share revenue, and that's going to lead them down a path that will not, I don't think, continue the growth that they had now. And so Roger has to figure out a way to keep the new owners happy and also keep the fundamental way the NFL has grown intact. And it's a mighty challenge, because there's like most of the owners now, Bill, are new. So he's a minority. I mean, he's been around longer than most of the owners have been, and they don't see the world the way the NFL used to. So Roger's got, as I said, a task ahead of him here.
Most of the league's revenue comes from the almost $4 billion it receives from its television package with NBC, CBS, Fox, ESPN, and DirecTV. Is it true that next season football fans will be able to just get a chip inserted into their heads and then they can download Monday Night Football directly into the Cortex for just $29.95 a month?
If it's not, it's their dream. I guarantee it's their dream. I mean, they keep putting it on different times, days, and I keep saying, you can't keep doing this, guys. It's going to go too far, and they never seem to be able to. I don't think there is a too far right now for the NFL. I mean, I literally think they could go out 7 days a week now, Bill, with TV games, and people would watch it, and the ratings would be high, and, they'd flourish. And I once thought that would ruin the golden egg, but I think the golden egg, basically this point can't be shattered.
So no such thing as overexposure as far as the National Football League.
Not in the NFL. safe ally. They don't recognize the word. And if you see their plans for the future, including the NFL Network, which needs to be mentioned here, they have big plans for the NFL Network. If they can figure out a way to get a revenue stream through the NFL Network that will somehow come to the same level as you just mentioned, the billions they get now, they're going to switch a lot of their programming over to the NFL Network. And I think that that's when the fans that we're talking about are going to really start getting upset, because a lot of this stuff that's on, what's left on free TV is going to be off of free TV, and it's going to enter a whole different world of television viewing.
Meanwhile, on the field, 8 meaningless games down, only 55 more meaningless games to go. The preseason is underway. Can you think of any one preseason game that we should actually watch?
Bill. Yeah, the last one, because that means we're almost ready to start the regular season.
There
That's always
go.
My bellwether one. You know, the bell cow, watch the last one because it means it's going to be over with. Now, I understand that a lot of teams sell season tickets and they include the preseason games or you don't get your season tickets, but why anyone would go and watch a preseason game when the starters only play 1 or 2 or 3 series is beyond me, and pay significant money, including parking and all those stuff. To me, it's one of the great ripoffs of all time, and it just continues to surprise me that they get these huge crowds for these games.
Well, since we don't even know who's going to get hurt between now and when those 55 remaining games are played, I will not ask you at this point to make any predictions about which two teams will be in the Super Bowl, okay?
That's right. Well, thank you, because, I would hold back anyway.
You'd be predicting defensively.
I don't want to ruin the rush early. I'm contemplating as we speak, and when you ask that question at the right time, I will be ready for you, Bill.
Paul Ettner covers the NFL for the Sporting News. Paul, thanks again.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
A lot of the discussion of biology, chemistry, and technology as they apply to peak athletic performance has been about steroids, human growth hormone, or blood doping. But science can also be employed to ensure an athlete's safety under the extreme circumstances often involved in training and in competition. Such is the case with a device called the Core Temp Pill, which has been increasingly utilized by professional and college football teams practicing during August. Susan Smith, the marketing and sales manager at HQ Incorporated, the company that manufactures the device, explains what it contains.
The pill is made up of a communications coil, a quartz crystal, a little circuit board, and a battery. And the quartz crystal is what measures the temperature as this pill travels through the body.
The temperature reading recorded by the pill, which is about the size of a cold capsule, gets transferred to a recorder monitored by somebody on the sideline who can tell when an athlete's temperature is beginning to climb. If that happens, the assistant coach or intern can signal to whoever's running the workout that the athlete who's overheating should be brought off the field to drink some water and cool down. The CoreTemp pill system, which was initially developed by NASA in order to monitor the temperature of astronauts, requires an initial investment of several $1,000s, and each pill, which can only be used once, costs at least $30. Susan Smith acknowledges that not all football programs can afford the temperature monitoring system.
The price of the system right now is limiting our ability to saturate the market. But we do have to stay in business. We have been able to be generous to some of our teams. We help them out however we can to get the system placed, whether it's, creative financing or payment plans, we're all open to that. But there is a battle between trying to make ourselves known and get the awareness out of the product and, still make money.
In the programs where money is no object, such as the football program at the University of Texas, there is considerable enthusiasm for the Core Temp pill. Kenny Boyd, the head football trainer at Texas, which started using the system this summer, says he's already seen the pill at work.
We've seen examples where there were a few guys that looked noticeably fatigued or washed out, and their temperatures were elevated. It gave us some warning signs and some other objective information to pull them back and get them in the shade and try to cool them down before they did start cramping up and did start that heat illness cycle.
It's tempting to conclude that anything that makes it less likely that a football player will suffer from heat exhaustion or heat stroke, the condition that killed Minnesota Viking lineman Corey Stringer 5 summers ago, is very good indeed. On the other hand, what's the likelihood that players swallowing the Core Temp pill will assume that they don't have to worry about how they feel because the system will warn somebody when it's time for them to slow down. That's one of the concerns of emergency room physician Eric Weiss, who is also the director of Wilderness Medicine at Stanford Medical Center. His endorsement of the pill is tempered by common sense and medical knowledge.
It's an excellent adjunct to monitoring an athlete's core temperature without shoving a thermometer in his mouth or ear. But I think it's also overrated a little bit. And the reason that we see athletes developing heat stroke is because there's a huge misconception with regard to the diagnosis and recognition of heat stroke. And it was even manifest several days ago on CNN by a medical correspondent who said that heat stroke is manifest when someone has hot, dry skin. And that is absolutely not true. That is found very late in heat stroke, but early on, people are still sweating. And if you wait for the absence of sweating, then you miss the diagnosis, and that's why football players and baseball players have died.
Dr. Weiss says no technology can replace careful observation and a clear understanding of the dangers players face when they're playing or practicing football on a very hot day, and that proper hydration and acclimatization, which may take as long as 14 days, can prevent heat stroke. Speaking for the manufacturer of the CoreTemp pill, Susan Smith agrees that it shouldn't be considered anything more than a tool, and that certainly it cannot replace a common-sense approach to training and practicing in the heat. But she says the football programs using the device have been enthusiastic about it, and that more programs at the professional, college, and high school level are expressing interest in the technology as word of its use is spreading. To send comments about what you've heard on Only a Game, pinpoint provocative podcasts, rifle through our voluminous audio archives, or see what our cameras have captured when we've been in the field, please visit onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a scrum for expats in upstate New York. But first, it will come as no surprise that college football teams inspire powerful loyalty among their fans. But this season, the costs associated with seeing those teams play may provoke some to find something else to do with their Saturday afternoons. In an article for the Wall Street Journal's weekend edition, Russell Adams reports on that development. He joins me now by phone. Russell, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Give us an idea of how prices for tickets and the fees for the right to purchase same have increased.
Well, generally speaking, even at the big-time college football programs, season ticket prices are still at a reasonable level. But where you are seeing a lot of the increases is in fees for the right to purchase season tickets. Mm-hmm. What we've seen in pro sports in recent years is sort of the evolution or the outgrowth of personal seat licenses, which are just a fee charged to season ticket holders for the right to buy a particular seat in a particular part of the stadium. The college version of that is often called minimum donations or donation requirements.
What a polite phrase.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of taps into your school spirit. But more and more schools are now realizing that in order to cover the escalating costs of running a successful football program, there really aren't a lot of areas for growth. And one of the untapped resources is the high-spending season ticket holders and the ones that are willing to pay a lot of money for either the club seats or the box seats or the 50-yard line seats. So what they do is say that in addition to the cost of the season ticket, you have to pay $500, $1,000 to guarantee that you will be able to buy that ticket or to give yourself a better chance.
The University of Louisville, never a world beater on the gridiron compared to some of the colleges you've mentioned, has instituted a particularly expensive procedure for fans who are interested in the best seats for games there. What's the cost of just competing for a good ticket to see Louisville play?
Well, what Louisville has done, and they've spent a lot of money and put a lot of resources in recent years into rebuilding or building up their football program, and they actually are finally consistently cracking the top 20, even the top 10 in some rankings. But it's come at a heavy cost. They implemented a system whereby, depending on where you want to sit, it costs you anywhere from $2,500 to $12,500 just for the option or the right to buy a season ticket to a Louisville game, and it's part of an effort to raise money for the athletic department.
I'm sure that something like that does raise money for the athletic department, and it's easy to see why it's needed. Programs like Texas spend about $16 million a year on football alone, which sounds awfully expensive.
Well, they're incredibly expensive. You have to remember also, somewhat in the defense of these football programs, as expensive as they are, they're often relied on to support the non-revenue generating sports at a lot of these athletic departments. So they're not only paying for football, they're paying for water polo and soccer and tennis.
So have you encountered any colleges or any universities where the applications for season tickets have fallen off because the university has overestimated the capacity of fans to pay or for some other reason?
Yes. At Oklahoma State, for example, they raised not only season ticket prices, but also the upfront fee associated with buying those ticket prices. And this was really bad timing on their part. They finished 4-7 last year, 1-7 in the conference, and interest was already waning, and it was a tenuous situation, but they had to do it. They say that they can't compete in the Big 12 conference unless they raise more money. And so far, by last report, sales were down about 20% from last year.
Which big-time college football programs are most likely to benefit from a strategy like this in the long term, and which are likely to suffer?
The ones that are most likely to benefit are the ones with traditionally the wealthiest alums, the USCs, the Notre Dames, the Michigans. They can all get away with this because they do have not only the avid interest in the team, in the program, but they have alums with deep pockets. And no matter how much they grumble, they will continue to give. And a lot of the biggest donors are donating way, way beyond anything that's required in order to purchase tickets. And clearly the schools like USC can get away with this and can raise a huge amount of money.
Is there a downside to favoring the richest donors by raising prices like this? Are schools running a risk of turning off people who've been long-time passionate supporters but don't have a whole lot of money?
Yes, exactly. It's a really delicate situation. There are a few schools like Virginia Tech that are undergoing very sort of delicate reseeding programs where the people that have been season ticket holders since the 1970s or whenever are going to get pushed into seats that are further up or not right on the 50-yard line in favor of season ticket holders that are willing to give more. And it's a tough thing for these schools because they have to try to reward people for their loyalty, but they also know that the economic realities of college football are such that you really can't give those seats away. And in this day and age, a 50-yard line seat for a big-time college football program can command a lot of money, and not getting a big donation is almost the equivalent of giving it away.
You write that rising fees and ticket costs are the result of a trend that has colleges and universities placing fundraising responsibilities on the football programs themselves. What are the potential benefits of self-sufficiency for a college football program?
Well, it's huge. I think the appetite for support from either the institution itself or from the students continues to wane. People are no longer willing to sit by and watch tuition costs rise while these college athletic departments get fat. And with that diminished appetite, schools are having to really look hard at how much they spend on football, how how much they spend on scholarships, on coaching staffs, on facilities, and either spending more smartly or, in other cases, looking to wealthy donors to provide this kind of support.
Russell Adams has written an article about the increasing cost of attending college football games for the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal. Russell, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Should you have been discouraged that some fans of University of Louisville football will pay $12,500 over the next 5 years for the privilege of buying tickets, or that fans of the University of Tennessee, which went 5-6 last season, must contribute $500 up front just to compete for $320 seats, don't despair. There are bargains out there in the world of sports. You just have to know where to look. Consider, for example, that you can buy a ticket to watch the best team in Major League Soccer, DC United, for $16. Should you wish to make a real night of it, for $61, you can acquire 4 spectator-level seats, a large one-topping pizza, and a soccer ball. You can watch the Phoenix Mercury, the WNBA team for which Diana Taurasi scored a record-setting 47 points Thursday night, for as little as $9. On Thursday night, that $9 would have bought you a triple overtime in which the Mercury and the Houston Comets combined for a record-setting 221 points. This works out to about 4 cents a point, which is a bargain no football game at any level is ever going to approach. Meanwhile, in Amarillo, Texas, the very same state in which UT is running a football program that costs $16 million a year, you can watch the Dusters of the Arena Football League for $15. Make that just $10 if you're a civil servant and $8 for students. I wonder what sort of discount they give a civil servant who's still in school. Minor league baseball is very popular, but apparently that hasn't encouraged its moguls to jack up prices. You can watch the Albuquerque Isotopes, the AAA affiliate of the Florida Marlins, for just $5 if you're willing to sit on the berm in the outfield. A genuine reserve seat is only $9, and I happen to know from personal experience that parking at Pawtucket Red Sox games is still free. Should you have lots of sports disposable income but feel you should get more than just a ticket for your investment, consider the Newport Beach Breakers, the world team tennis outfit for which Pete Sampras played this summer. For $1,900, the price of the Platinum Box Seat Package, the Breakers will provide you with 4 front row box seats for all home matches. They'll put your family's name on the box and give you 4 invitations to a reception at which you can meet the members of the team, 2 opportunities to play with the members of the team in a pro-am event, all the parking, snacks, and beverages you'll ever need, 5 golden rings and a partridge in a pear tree. Now, I'm kidding about that last part, but you've got to acknowledge it's still a lot better deal than forking out a couple of grand a year just for the opportunity to buy tickets to a football game. Each year in a tiny Adirondack village, more than 100 teams gather for one of the biggest rugby tournaments in the U.S. For more than 3 decades, teams and players have been coming to Saranac Lake's Can-Am Rugby Tournament from as far away as Africa and Australia. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann attended this year's edition where he witnessed the fervor and the fractures.
Over here! Leave it! Good rock! Good rock, Jason Van Zeelen, good rock.
Mid-morning, great herds of men crash up and down the Saranac Lake High School football field. Most look middle-aged. None wear pads or helmets. This is a premier division match between 2 New York squads, the Albany Knicks and the Brockport Doggies.
I took a knee or a spike to my chin.
Jason Richard from Herkimer, New York, is a proud doggie and logistics manager for a life insurance company. His head is a cocoon of bandage and gauze. He's a good living advertisement for his employer.
It's not as bad as it looks. I took 20 stitches in my chin to close it up, but I'm okay.
As we talk on the sidelines, one of the opposing players crashes face down in the grass, knocked cold as a slab of beef.
They're doing all kinds of stuff up and down, but it's controlled. There's a plan, strategy, a lot of strategy.
So there's a guy down there. It looks like he's just not moving.
Don't touch him. Don't touch him. He got hit. He'll be okay.
An ambulance rolls up, and soon Lisa Muscatello, a certified athletic trainer from the local hospital, is bent over the unconscious man, waving smelling salts under his nose and gauging the size of his pupils.
You're fine. This is good. Stay.
The player comes to. He looks okay, but just to be sure, they cart him off on a stretcher. Muscatello shakes her head and sighs. It's been a busy weekend.
As the speeds get faster, the younger guys, we see a lot of head injury, lacerations, some pretty big ones. In fact, we had quite a few today, this morning.
To somebody like me, this looks crazy.
To me, it looks crazy. I wouldn't want to be a rugby player. Yes, it's very busy under the big tent. And then we also have people manning the perimeter field, so you just never know what's going to happen.
Only a handful of the competitors here are paid to play, and those earn only a pittance. So why would middle-aged men and women subject themselves to this kind of brutal punishment? Jay Annis is lead organizer of the Can-Am tournament and plays for the Saranac Lake Mountaineers rugby squad.
For the old boys, it's all about saying we could have, we should have, we still can.
Here's a surprise for someone new to rugby. For the most part, this isn't a blue-collar sport. It's a game that's been kept alive on college campuses, often by foreign athletes like Canadian Kelly Seary.
My mother actually made me promise to never play rugby again before sending me off to college. And so it took me a few weeks to break the news to her that I was choosing to play rugby again.
Seary played rugby at Harvard and works now for the Harvard Medical Center. She captains Boston's Beantown rugby squad.
I mean, I weigh 115 pounds, so I do occasionally leave my feet and hope for the best.
One of Siri's teammates is Sharon Blaney, a social worker who counsels homeless women. She's sporting a lip that looks like a mushed strawberry.
I just got hit in the head. I might not be the best person to interview.
What happened?
Oh, I just got hit hard.
You all right?
Yeah, no, I'm good. My lips are swollen.
When I ask why she plays, Blaney shrugs as if the question doesn't make sense.
Because I love it. I wouldn't do anything else.
Can you explain why you love it? Because I think most people hearing this are going to say, okay, I hear her saying the words, but maybe she's crazy.
Especially
given
her head.
Exactly. Because I like the way that rugby challenges you emotionally, physically, mentally, everything. Pushes you to a different, higher level.
Did you almost say challenges you medically?
It might, yeah. Financially, everything.
Once you've played it, you just love it.
Jan Plumador came to Saranac Lake in the 1970s after discovering rugby at law school.
I even got a chance to play in Australia when I was an R&R from Vietnam. It's a game that gets in your blood. Some people are golf addicts. I guess I have to confess to being a rugby addict.
These days, Plumador is a New York State Supreme Court judge. He organized the first rugby team here in the mountains when he got tired of commuting all the way to New York City to find matches. In the mid-70s, Plumador and his mates organized a small tournament, which grew beyond anyone's expectations, drawing teams from Canada and overseas.
They're quite amazed when they come to these shores and participate. We've had several English teams. We had a team from Zimbabwe. We had teams from Argentina. We'd like to attract a few more Southern Hemisphere teams.
I started playing when I was 5 years old.
Foreign athletes like Nick Prescott from Guildford, England, say they're surprised and delighted to find rugby thriving in a village like Saranac Lake. Prescott lives in Connecticut now. He says tournaments like this one help fill a void in the U.S., where older players struggle to find top-tier competition.
The biggest problem that they have is the U.S. doesn't have a professional level set up for the guys to really get exposure, so that when they get to international matches, they've got a real chance.
McCracken, get in there, hurry up. Come on, Jimmy!
On this day, there's plenty of exposure, plenty of swollen eyes, lacerated cheekbones, and twisted ankles. But at the end of the day, teams that were warring only a few minutes before hang together like members of the same tribe. They march off to the pubs and the taverns, where they'll tell war stories and lick their wounds and talk strategy for the next face-off. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in Saranac Lake, New York.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at bicon.com, bicon.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a not especially magical but sometimes mysterious baseball tour. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Tuesday, Roger Goodell was unanimously elected the NFL's next commissioner. Meet the new Tagliabue, same as the old Tagliabue?
It's a straight line of succession. Roger Goodell is an NFL lifer, son of Charles Goodell. Those of us who are our age or a little older will remember as the dovish Republican senator from New York. He has a couple of things on the horizon. Most significantly, either side can opt out of the current collective bargaining agreement in 2008, in November of 2008, actually the middle of the season. And there seem to be indications from both sides that they're not happy. So that, I think, will be the first real test.
How can they not be happy? This is a money machine.
Well, it's a money machine without guaranteed money. So if you're a player, you realize how disposable you are.
I get it. When the first NFL season presided over by Roger Goodell begins, fans in Cincinnati will have the opportunity to rat out people who misbehave during home games at Paul Brown Stadium. Keeping sports stadia free of bad fans should always be the responsibility of good fans, don't you think?
I agree, but this is, after all, the Bengals, and they should have set up another number for the players, given the fact of what's been going on with their roster and the law the last couple of years. The interesting thing to me is the number, which we will give out to our fans in case they want to, like, phone in their grandparents or something in Cincinnati as a goof, is 513-381-JERK. They couldn't get an 800 number? You got to pay to report the guy who just poured beer on your head? No wonder the Bengals are reputed to be cheap.
Have we evidence that Judge Beverly Grant, who asked everybody in her courtroom to chant Go Seahawks last February, has learned her lesson?
I hope so. The State Judicial Conduct Commission has reprimanded her. Actually, they gave her an admonishment, which is the lowest you can do. Apparently, she was trying to get people to lighten up during a manslaughter trial. That's her job, I have no idea. But she says she won't do it again.
Does Clay Bennett, the new owner of the NBA team and the WNBA team in Seattle, have a case when he maintains that Key Arena, where the Sonics and Storm currently play, is not satisfactory?
No, probably not. He's probably trying to gouge the taxpayers, and we shouldn't listen to him, although it is entirely possible that he would abandon Seattle, where the Supersonics really have made quite a history for themselves.
In late-season WNBA action, coincidentally, the Seattle Storm clinched a playoff berth by beating the Detroit Shock on Tuesday night. So that should guarantee that the Storm at least stays in Seattle,
right? Yes, they'll leave the Storm in Key Arena and move the Supersonics somewhere else. The Storm blew a 25-point second-half lead but managed to hang on anyway.
Elsewhere in hoops, real estate mogul Donald Sterling, also the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, has been sued for discriminating against minorities. The NBA certainly cares about what players do off the court. How much does it care about what owners do in the businesses that enabled them to buy into the league?
Well, I think that, you know, given the history of the Clippers, which has sort of been the plague ship of the NBA for years and years, this can't help. Now they seem to have turned it around competitively, and their owner goes back to being an out-of-control dope in his business life. I'm sure he'll be getting a phone call from Manhattan very soon.
Should we give a shout-out to the Kansas City Royals, who, despite the fact that they're about 35 games behind Detroit in the AL Central and about 25 games behind the Red Sox in the league standing, swept the 2004 World Series champs in Kansas City this week?
Yes, the Red Sox, we can give a little bit of a shout-out to the Kansas City Royals, even though they probably won't hear us. The Red Sox are in real trouble. They lost five in a row, not to the best teams in the league. They've got one of the toughest stretches of their schedule coming up. Their starting pitching, which is supposed to have been one of their strengths, is falling apart completely. It even looks like Jonathan Papelbon, their rookie closer, who had been the arguably the MVP of the team and possibly the league at the first half of the season, is starting to come unstrung a little bit too. And the Yankees have reloaded, and this is a team that's in trouble now.
August is usually a pretty slow month for hockey stories, but we should acknowledge that Harry Sinden, who had been associated with the Boston Bruins for 40 years, the last 17 of them as team president, retired this week. Any words for Mr. Sinden as he steps down?
See you, Harry. I hope it was worth it for you, because you've managed to pull the wool over the eyes of some of the best hockey fans in the world for a long, long time. He was the director of what could arguably be called consumer fraud, a team that wanted to make money without necessarily winning, and he managed to do it. And congratulations, Harry. Enjoy your retirement.
Michelle Wee has made almost $750,000 playing golf this season, Charlie, but she hasn't won an LPGA tournament yet. And this week we learned that it's the caddy's fault. Boy, he must feel awful.
Well, Greg Johnson is the most recent one to get the heave-ho. Apparently this has been somewhat symptomatic of the Wee family approach to golf. Between 2003 and 2005, she'd gone through 9 caddies. As one caddy told SportsIllustrated.com, every time she misses a green, it's the caddy's fault, except when dad's on the bag. So I think that either her father, BJ, or her mother, Bo, is going to be carrying the bag for the rest of her career, because I don't think she's going to be able to find anybody else who will.
And now we move on to our record of the week with a composition entitled Pieces of Hope to the Echo of the World. Patrick Way has become the composer of the world's longest poem. Can this really be true? Longer than Beowulf or 100 bottles of beer on the wall?
7,600 verses written on a roll of fabric in a very Kerouac-esque fashion. And it was displayed, and this is where the sports come in, because people are at home wondering, why is this on a sports program? It was unrolled on a racetrack.
There you go.
It was the only way to do it. So I guess there were some curves and turns in the narrative, unexpected twists at the far turn. But it was also unrolled by a tractor.
And
we have tractor pulls, so there we are.
Besides, it was a contest. There was a result. Right. I refuse to apologize.
And he's already written two shorter poems, one of 217 feet and one of 236 feet. They must have been limericks.
And finally, Charlie, Wall Street Journal reporter Stefan Fatsis, who, by the way, was only a game sports business guy before a certain unnamed radio program found a free agency loophole and stole him away. He's attained the level of sports glory unheard of for most scribes. Do you get a boot out of this story?
Yeah, he kicked himself a 27-yard field goal, and not only did he kick it, the Broncos picked him up and carried him off the field.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. By most accounts, Albert Spaulding was a terrific pitcher back in the baseball days when the hurlers threw underhand and the batter got to say where he wanted the ball. By all accounts, Albert Spaulding was an even better businessman, as demonstrated by the fact that the company bearing his name is still selling sporting goods more than a century after Spaulding hung up his spikes. In Spaulding's world tour, subtitled The Epic Adventure That Took Baseball Around the Globe and Made It America's Game, Mark Lamster tells the story of Albert Spaulding's most ambitious undertaking, an unprecedented traveling baseball show that took place in 1888. Mark Lamster joins me now from the NPR Bureau in New York City. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The first games of the fabulous 1888 tour that Spaulding organized were played as the players traveled across the U.S. from the East Coast to the West, and a lot of those games were terrible. Do you suppose Spaulding had any second thoughts about this adventure before it really started?
I think not at all. The fact that they were losing was almost good for business, because one of the things that drew people out to see these baseball players out west, where there was no Major League Baseball at this time, remember, mm-hmm. was the opportunity to see these guys. And whether or not they lost or won didn't matter on one level. On another level, they were playing exhibition games not only against each other, two teams went on this tour, but they would play exhibition games against the best local semi-pro team. Of course, the fans would just love to see their local team beat the vaunted pros from back east. So if they were losing to these teams, it was actually great for business. And the worse they did, the more press coverage that drew. And Spalding was a firm believer that all press is good press, and he was quite right.
Taking baseball around the world by staging a string of games between his own Chicago team and a collection of alleged all-stars had to be a risky undertaking. What made Albert Spalding think that people in Australia and India and Egypt would care about baseball?
He had a good sense the people of Australia, which was his prime target for spreading baseball, would care. Australia was sort of a culture like America, as a country on the rise, and no real sport to call their own. As for the rest of the world, I think he was a lot more suspect as to whether baseball would actually be taken there. Certainly, I don't think he ever believed that, you know, they would play a game at the pyramids and all of a sudden it would become the most popular sport in Egypt. But really, the object here was to promote baseball in America, to show Americans that baseball was their game, and to do that by playing the game overseas and saying, hey, look where we're playing our national game. So, you know, we're playing it, you know, at the Colosseum in Rome. We're playing it at the Eiffel Tower in Paris. We're playing it at the pyramids. That was exciting, and it would keep baseball in the press and be just a great boon to business.
One of the more fascinating aspects of this ambitious tour was, at least to me, was that Spalding initially told the players accompanying him that they would be playing a series of games as they traveled across the U.S., and then they would go to Australia to introduce the game there. Did any of the players object when he subsequently told them they'd be returning home via Africa and Europe?
They were actually quite thrilled when he told them, although he was, I believe, very, very nervous that there would be a giant mutiny when he he set this plan upon them. He did not tell them until they were sailing on the Pacific and there was no turning back. And then he leaked the news that they could perhaps go on this tour around the world. And, of course, this piqued everyone's interest and everyone's excitement got up. And instead of reacting negatively, they were all so excited by the possibility that it just became everyone was thrilled to do it and he couldn't keep them from it. So he was just a very, very savvy political maneuverer.
You write that it was, and I'm quoting here, the great irony of his life that Albert Spalding managed to make his own name virtually synonymous with transparency, square dealing, and rectitude. Are you suggesting he was a crook?
Crook, I would say, was too strong a word, but certainly he had no problems fixing facts to suit his interest. I think most famously, Spalding today is responsible for the myth that Abner Doubleday invented baseball in Cooperstown in 1839. And we came upon this myth for essentially the same reason that we came upon this tour. Albert Spalding was absolutely convinced that baseball had to be defined as America's game. And he became more and more vociferous on this. At about the turn of the century, he established this commission that would determine once and for all who or how baseball evolved. And this committee received a letter from a guy named Abner Graves from Denver, who was a complete crackpot. And he claimed that in 1839, this Civil War hero named Abner Doubleday had, you know, sketched out baseball's first diamond on the dirt in front of a tailor shop in Cooperstown, New York. Now, it was clear that this was not the first time baseball was played. It was obvious. But it was so perfect for Spalding. Here was an American hero inventing America's game that, of course, it was too good to pass up. And the fact that Doubleday also happened to be a member of this obscure occult group of which Spalding's wife was also associated, Theosophists, that made things almost too perfect. So, of course, Spalding was so powerful within baseball at that point that he could essentially force the commission to adopt this as gospel. And so today, still, people believe that baseball is an invention of Abner Doubleday, which it certainly was not.
Regarding the tour, in what is now Sri Lanka, Spalding's players engaged in what you call a wild rickshaw race. In Egypt, they hit the Sphinx in the eye with baseballs. At a parade in Paris, they beamed the Prince of Wales with flowers. Is it fair to say some of these ball players were early prototypes for the ugly American?
Yes, it definitely is that. You read through this and it's at some points appalling. And of course, the great irony here is that Spalding was constantly selling these baseball players as exponents of American virtue and decorum. And here they were going around, you know, tossing baseballs at the eye of the Sphinx and doing all these other ridiculous things. Basically, they were received quite well, especially in Europe. And I think you have to remember that the world at that time was very interested and curious about America and who Americans were, and also about this game of baseball. America was a country on the rise. It was a land of opportunity and energy, and everyone was interested to know what was happening in America. It was clearly, you didn't need a crystal ball to see that this was the place of the future. Although it's easy to make fun of them for doing the silly things that they did, they actually put on a fairly decent show of themselves most of the time.
Toward the end of the book, you say that profit was not Spalding's motive in staging the 1888 World Tour, and in fact he lost money on the tour. But if we take the long view of his ambitions, wasn't ultimate profit a very big part of his plan?
Absolutely. I think Spalding had a lot of ambitions, and they were intertwined inextricably. For him to profit, for baseball to conquer the world, for it to become defined as America's game, these were all goals that he had for his career and for his life and that he sought after. And it's easy to say, well, he was really just after the commercial end, but I don't think it's true. I think he so associated all of these things together, his own personal fortune, the fortune of baseball, and the fortune of America. To him, they were all the same. And I think that's almost the most telling thing about his personality.
Mark Lamster is the author of Spalding's World Tour, the epic adventure that took baseball around the globe and made it America's game, published by Public Affairs. He spoke to me from the NPR Bureau in New York City. Mark, thank you very much for joining me.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Simon Wood, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Spalding's World Tour, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the final word.
I'm tired.
I guess after 13 years of steadfast service, Mr. Final Word deserves a week off. But he better be ready next week. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you then.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.